From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, killing off DACA.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
The president gives Congress 6 months to come up with a replacement.
Congress has never made a decision that fast on something that helps people. Everybody knows that.
Plus, seasonal businesses around Mackinac need more foreign-born workers.
The population in Mackinac City and the surrounding communities is just very small compared to the amount of seasonal businesses that we've got up here.
And cool new music from West Michigan.
My mix of music this month might make your head spin.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for being here. Coming up on today's show, the college experience can change from generation to generation. Later, we talk about the mental health issues facing today's college students and explore some coping mechanisms.
There is job market shrinking, the resources are shrinking for this generation, and then there is all this political chaos around us.
But first, today is the day kids all around Michigan went back to school. That's unless your school was among the record number to begin before Labor Day this year. We stopped by Ann Arbor's Ba Elementary this morning to hear how some of the kids are feeling on their first day of school.
I'm nervous and I'm excited.
You get to see all your friends again. You don't know what's going on during the summer.
Yeah, and you sometimes don't know the personalities of your teacher and what they'll be like.
Our teacher is a science teacher, scientist, but whatever. And so that's why I'm pretty excited for science.
I like that I get to have my own desk.
Your own desk.
The note says that the classroom has like games, books, lots and all that stuff.
No, I'm not in fifth grade. I'm second grade.
Going to the first grade.
Yeah, I'm feeling me. I'm so excited to read. Don't know how to read.
I'm most excited about having a new teacher.
I'm so excited. So excited to see the kids. I've been able to see a couple over the summer, and it's just, they're so excited, and the first day's magical.
Hello,
Ian. Morning.
Whose class did you get?
I'm excited because I get to see all my friends again and everything, and because my teacher, people say she's really nice.
All summer I've been lonely, and I wanted to see my friends again, and I missed all the teachers, and this school is really great.
Those were students Milo Varnum, Aiden Reed, Amanda Ramirez, Evan Ray, Preston Eaton, Zoran Babrawala, Leo Stone, and Cecile Pifferetti. And the first day of school is a big one for parents, too.
Really nice to have the kids back in school and learning and have adult lives back, at least for part of the day.
Incredibly excited.
Yeah, definitely excited to get him back into school and maybe start working his brain a little bit more again. He's had a good break, but seems like it's time.
Sí, estoy muy contenta. Me gusta mucho esta escuela.
Well, it's nice to have them back at school.
Moving now to immigration. Last Friday, President Trump was asked about the future of the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the one that allows undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children to remain in the country.
We love the dreamers. We love everybody. Thank you very much.
Well, that was Friday. Today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Good morning. I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
Yes, as expected, the Trump administration will phase out the program. It's giving Congress 6 months to pass some kind of replacement program for the nearly million Dreamers who have signed up for DACA. One of those Dreamers is with us now. Julio Mejia Andino is a DACA recipient. He lives in Michigan. And Julio, you say you have no problem at all with us using your name. And why is that?
There's no reason for me to hide my name. There's nothing for me to hide. And
they've got all your information, don't they?
They do. I mean, they got it multiple times already. They got information from the past 10 years that I lived in this country.
What brought you to Michigan, and where did you grow up in Michigan?
Well, my parents brought me to Michigan, and we grew up in southwest Detroit. And later on, we moved on to Redford, and I lived in Redford since.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Southwestern High School, and then I went to Redford Union High School. And I'm currently enrolled in Schoolcraft College.
And as far as family members here in Michigan, who's here?
I have my siblings, my mom. They live here. Two of them, which are DACA beneficiaries, and the other ones were born here.
So the three of you, you and your two siblings, are coping with this news today.
Yeah, some of us better than others.
Tell us, how and when did you first come to the United States from Honduras?
I came from Honduras back in 1999 at the very end. I just turned 9, and we came here through Texas. Actually, it was just me. My mom was already here, and it was with a family friend that I crossed the border.
And Julio, what did it mean to you when the DACA policy was first rolled out in 2012? How did you feel about that?
I felt free. I felt like I could be part of something, I guess. You know, living through high school and even after high school, couldn't really do much. You don't have that kind of freedom. But after DACA, it gave me all that.
Did you have any doubts, any hesitation about registering for DACA?
I did not. As soon as I heard about it, I was running to get a lawyer, running to find all the information I could, all the requirements that I needed, and I applied as soon as I could.
How did it change your life?
Drastically. I mean, I was able to drive, go to school. I have a great job now that I found. You know, they gave me the opportunity. It made me not feel foreign or as foreign anymore.
What are some of the thoughts and feelings that you're having right now as this news breaks?
uncertainty. I don't know. That is the answer that comes to mind. I keep asking myself the same question, and that's the answer I keep giving myself. I don't know.
And you just had your DACA status renewed for 2 years this past July, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Do you have any idea, in light of today's announcement, what that means?
I don't know what it means. Again, I don't know this. Right now, I guess it looks like I got 6 months, and everybody, you know, expects Congress to make a decision in 6 months. I doubt that's going to happen. Congress has never made a decision that fast on something that helps people. Everybody knows that.
Julio, when is the last time you were back to Honduras?
I never gone back.
So you haven't been there since you were 9 years old?
Nope. I can't leave the country. If I leave the country, what are the chances of me coming back?
Do you have family there? Are there people you know?
I'm sure I have family, but it's not like I kept daily contact with them. Last time I spoke to them, on the phone, it was like probably 6 years ago, 7 years ago.
If you had a chance to sit down face-to-face with President Trump or with Attorney General Sessions and advisor Stephen Miller, who strongly pushed the president to end DACA, what would you say to them?
That's a tough question. I would have to ask them, what would they do if they were parents and coming from a third world country? Well, what would they do for their children's future? Would they bring them to a country where they're going to suffer consequences later on? Or would they stay in a third world country? What kind of decisions would they make if they were parents?
Have you thought, Julio, about what options you may have? And I know this announcement just happened this morning, but I know you've been thinking about the possibility, options you have or actions that you might be forced to take.
Yes, I think about it on a daily basis.
And what might that look like?
Me me getting, leaving the country and having to start over, preferably not in a third world country, but somewhere where I could, I don't know, live the same life that I lived here. I don't know.
Is there a sense of betrayal right now for you?
Definitely. I mean, who's to say they're not going to use the information I gave them? They already went this far.
Julio Mejia Andino, a DACA recipient who came here from Honduras at the age of 9. We want to thank you so much for spending some time and speaking with us.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Many, many Michigan resorts, hotels, and restaurants really count on the summer months to make or break their year. And some also really count on seasonal workers from abroad who come here on H-2B visas. With all the attention on the U.S. immigration policy over the last year, we wanted to check in to see how businesses fared this year now that the summer vacation season of 2017 has ended. Here with us from Mackinac City is Tracy Darrow. She owns Darrow's Family Restaurant. Good to have you here with us, Tracy.
Thank you very much.
How long has Darrow's been open?
We've been in business as a restaurant for 60 years.
And how important now, as we talk in 2017, are these foreign workers to your restaurant?
Probably more than ever. Because of the lack of visas this year, we were unable to bring our workers in until recently. We were able to obtain some of the additional visas that Congress had approved back in May, and Homeland Security and Department of Labor finally released the end of July. It's made a huge difference. Our people were working 7 days a week since we had opened, some of them 12 to 15 hours a day, and it was, a matter of getting them some relief. We actually had considered shutting down one day a week just so that the cooks and the kitchen staff could get a day off.
And we should explain to everyone that basically there's a cap of 66,000 foreign workers every year. And the government did not used to count returning foreign workers against the cap. But a year ago, Congress tightened that pipeline by refusing to renew the traditional exemption. So returning workers were counted against the cap. So that did mean a lot of hardship for businesses like yours. Now, when did you begin to have to rely on foreign workers?
We've been using H-2B visas probably since about the year 2000.
And why?
Because there just is not enough qualified workers in our area. The population in Mackinac City and the surrounding communities is just very small compared to the amount of seasonal businesses that we've got up here.
And yet, when we think that the president is complaining about foreign workers taking jobs from Americans, what do you feel when you hear that?
To me, it's not an immigration issue. It's a labor issue. Hmm. I understand, there is some concern that we are not hiring American workers. And I can guarantee you that the process to bring in H-2B visas is costly and time-consuming. And by all means, if I could find American workers, it would be to our benefit to do that.
And as you indicated, Homeland Security did open the door to 15,000 more H-2B workers in July. So you were able to get a few more helping hands and probably give the folks that were working 7 days a week a bit of a breather.
Right. Our problem was Congress had approved 77,000, probably as you know, back in May. And for whatever reason, from talking to our congressman's office, Homeland Security and Department of Labor kept bouncing responsibility back and forth. Hmm. And when the visas were finally issued, it wasn't until end of July, and at that point there was only 15,000. Whereas if they would have done it back in May, not only would we have benefited, but I'm sure a lot of businesses across the country would have benefited as well.
Tracy, what do you want to see happen in Washington? What kind of solution would lift this worry from your shoulders?
Well, I think if they went back to the returning worker exemption, that would make a huge difference. And like I said, I think that the general consensus has to be that it's not an immigration issue, it's a labor shortage. And there are just too many restaurant, hospitality-type positions, as well as, when you read about the other stuff, the landscape workers and that type of thing, that there's just not enough workers that are willing and able to do those types of jobs.
Tracy, where do most of your workers come from, and what jobs do they hold at your restaurant?
We mainly use people from Jamaica. We've been using the same staff. Some of them have been with us since 2000 up to 2002. You know, when you have people that return every year, they not only know the job, you know their skills, and it just makes life that much simpler to have consistency and run a good business.
But as you say, the worry is not going away. Although, interestingly, the president, his Mar-a-Lago resort, relies just like you do on H-2B workers. So it seems that cap or the problem with renewing the returning workers, that was a year ago. So that was before the president was elected.
Well, and I do know that, you know, the president was able, from what we've understood, to get workers from Mar-a-Lago. And then he had also applied for some of the additional 15,000 visas that were available in July. So as far as I can tell, he's got to realize that this is also a labor problem, not an immigration problem, or he wouldn't have tried to get more workers for his resort as well.
Do you hear similar stories from other business owners in Mackinac City or on Mackinac Island?
Certainly on Mackinac Island and in Mackinac City. You know, I know that there are certain places that had if you have an April 1 start date, they were able to start the process a little bit sooner. By the time we were we don't have that early of a start date, and by the time we were even submitting our paperwork this year, we knew that the visas were all gone. I know that first week of January, there's only 33,000 visas that are available for the first 6 months, and from what I could tell on the websites, 55,000 had already been positions had already been applied for that first week of January. So we knew before we even sent our paperwork in that the visas were going to be gone and that we were going to, have a huge shortage this year. We ran ads probably pretty much nonstop from February until July and just weren't able to get enough people.
Do you worry this crunch could threaten the future of your restaurant?
Oh, absolutely. We've already discussed what's going to happen next year if we're not able to get workers. We use the H-2B workers for the kitchen, for cooks, for prep cooks and for dishwashers. And, if it's anything like it is this year, we're going to have to shorten either hours and or eliminate days, which in turn is going to impact, our local workers, state taxes, all that kind of stuff that gets paid by payroll.
An enormous ripple effect.
Absolutely.
Tracy Darrow is the owner of Darrow's Family Restaurant, part of the dining scene in Mackinac City for 60 years. Tracy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
It's time for our monthly check-in on the music scene in West Michigan. John Sinkovich is back with us. He, of course, is editor and publisher of the localspins.com website, which covers West Michigan's music scene. And, John, you have lined up three very different artists and styles for us this month, that's for sure.
Yeah, Cynthia, I think my mix of music this month might make your head spin, but I think that speaks to the nature of what's going on in Michigan in general. A lot of eclectic, diverse acts are really starting to make an impact, so it could be fun this month.
All right, let's take our trip. We're going to start with Lady Ace Boogie. Before we hear from her title track from her second album, Don't Box Me, and tell us her backstory.
So Grand Rapids Lady Ace Boogie didn't take long to make an impact here in Grand Rapids on the West Michigan hip-hop scene. Linda Tellis, which is her real name, moved to Grand Rapids from Dayton, Ohio about, 7 years ago or so after growing up in West Virginia, and she really has a fascinating backstory. At one time, as she puts it, she was completely immersed in the gang culture and the street life of Dayton. And then a friend was beaten to a pulp, she says, by fellow gang members, and that kind of changed her attitude. And when she moved to Grand Rapids, she found this really collaborative and supportive music scene here, and that kind of led her to record and release her debut album, which was titled Feel Good Music, and that's an appropriate title because it really is upbeat, feel-good music. She oozes positivity and love when you see her live, and she's definitely cultivated a big audience of fans and with other musicians and rappers as well.
All right, let's take a listen to some of the title track from her second album, Don't Box Me In.
Been at it for a minute. Yes, we do this. Yes, make sure when you mention me, just please don't box me in. I'ma keep my foot up on it. Next, make sure when you mention me, just please don't box me in.
Queen of the city, but you already know. I'm gonna keep on rocking till I can't rock no more. Can't rock no more. Gatsby, Gatsby. I'll be in the city with a Dazby, Dazby. Tick of being humble, you can find me. Got the whole city right behind me, behind me. L.A.B. Capital C-A-double-L-A-B. Shout out to the 7 for the dope as hell beat. And if you ain't moving, better sit your tail down. Take a couple of seats.
Been at it for a minute. Guess yes, we do this. Make sure when you...
What do you like most, John, about her brand of hip-hop?
Well, it's interesting, and she's got this smooth style, but I really like the sheer exuberance that she exhibits. And when you see her live, that really comes to bear. It's just something that is very infectious, and I think it really does get the attention of a lot of people. I know her new album, her sophomore album, features Hip Hop Artist Days on one of the songs, and I know she's already released a video for Love For Me For Me, which is a really upbeat sort of a thing as well. And I think while this album has a duskier, a little bit more lush and biting quality to it than her first album, it's still got that classic Lady Ace Boogie style.
Now we're going to change gears in a big way to someone who is really pushing the envelope in bluegrass. Here's Billy Strings.
Tinfoil. I could wait my early life. I could see you in the darkness, and I'm running through the night. I recall a silver morning when your face had turned to gray. You were standing right before me, but I missed you every day. Though you never said you're sorry, give you even then, but I feel inconsequential in the current state I'm in.
Now that is some really, really interesting bluegrass. So tell us, who is Billy Strings? Where is he from?
So he grew up in Ionia and eventually moved up to Traverse City, where he met up with this veteran mandolinist by the name of Don Julin. And they hit it off, and they toured regularly across the region and the country for a couple of years, and really picked up a big following. And partly because Billy Strings is just absolutely eye-popping in the way he plays the acoustic guitar. I remember going to a couple of shows early on when I first saw him, and the place is absolutely packed. People are huddled around him. They're standing on tables to get a look at him playing the guitar, and he's all sweat-drenched and just having a ball up there. And he's really impressed, obviously, fans of bluegrass music, but also the critics. He won Instrumentalist of the Year honors from the International Bluegrass Music Association as part of its Momentum Awards. And then last month, Rolling Stone magazine kind of named him one of 10 new country artists you need to know. And he's got this new album coming out on September 22nd called Turmoil and Tinfoil. Foil that really sort of exhibits this kind of dark, kind of psychedelic, really interesting and fast-moving bluegrass music.
Now, Billy Strings is based in Nashville these days, but what, he's got a tour date coming up in Ferndale?
Yes, he does. He'll be playing Otis Supply in Ferndale on October 10th, but the thing is that he and his band are touring constantly, and they'll be crisscrossing the country through the end of the year. Obviously, he'll be back in West Michigan at some point or another here in 2018, but as he puts it, this is what he does, and he really was trying on this album to go a little bit outside of what he calls the bluegrass box. Producer Glenn Brown is well known in Michigan for his engineering and did a great job of pulling this all together, and there's a lot of hope that this is really going to accelerate him to that next level, and he's already a star in the bluegrass scene.
Well, he can check the box. He did certainly push the envelope for bluegrass. I thought it was absolutely fascinating. Really, really cool stuff from Billy Strings. And now we move over to Lipstick Jody, which is the name of the band, right? Not the singer.
Yes, that is the name of the band. Garage rocking, indie, alt pop. They've been firing up stages around here for quite some time, but this is really their first full-length album that they're going to be releasing later this month. It's chock full of this really infectious kind of catchy, and yet somehow aggressive tracks. They're kind of retro sounding, they're kind of airy sounding at times, but I'll tell you what, the thing that makes this band stand out is they're just plain fun to watch. I think it's great that they've got this new album finally out there, and I think a lot more fans are going to embrace what they do. The new album is self-titled Lipstick Jody. It's a follow-up to their 2015 EP, which was called Good Not Great.
All right, let's take a listen to a track called All I Have to Do by Lipstick Jody.
Get up, make thy feet. Get up and see. We're followed by ghostly. Just get up.
You are really, really enthused about this band and its sound.
Yeah, it's led by a singer guitarist by the name of Carly Morehouse. They've got Luke Rockhold on drums, Camille Horn on bass, and Jamie Barman on keyboards. The new album was recorded at River City Studios here and produced by Austin Roostorfer, and I think they did a really good job of representing what this pop band is all about. And I think people, once they hear the music and the album, they're going to go want to see them live.
And there is an upcoming release party for their new album. It's, what, September 28th in Grand Rapids?
Exactly. At Stash Inside the Intersection downtown.
Sounds a lot of fun. All right, so just to recap, once again, Lipstick Jody, their new album is Lipstick Jody. Billy Strings really, really changing the conversation about bluegrass with the album Turmoil and Tinfoil. And Lady Ace Boogie, Don't Box Me In. You can learn more about these and all other kinds of West Michigan artists by going to localspins.com, edited and published by our West Michigan music guide, John Sinkovich. It's always fun, John. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Domino's Pizza and Ford have begun testing driverless car pizza delivery in Ann Arbor. M-City will be testing a driverless shuttle around U of M's North Campus this fall. No doubt about it, driverless cars are coming. With that comes a new challenge: how to make those driverless cars safe for pedestrians. Michael Klaman is part of a team at the Humans and Autonomy Lab at Duke University looking into this very question, and he is with us now via Skype. And Michael, when we think about what it takes to cross a street safely, so much of that centers on me being able to make some legit eye contact with the driver, as in, you see me, right? You can't do that with an autonomous vehicle.
That's right, and that's one of the problems that a lot of researchers, including us at Duke, are looking into, is that we're taught from a very young age to look for those types of cues, to, you know, best case scenario, to make eye contact or, you know, look for that polite wave coming from the driver. But one of the issues is that with driverless cars, that driver isn't really going to be there anymore. The person who's sitting in the front seat of the car is going to be a passenger, and then it's going to be up to the pedestrian to communicate with the car instead of with a human being.
I know there's been research, your team and others, as you wrote about this in The Conversation, kind of looking at how people respond when they realize a driverless vehicle's approaching. This is all new. It's a brave new world for everybody. How are people responding?
Well, it's interesting. There's a certain amount of breadth to that research because it's really an emerging field. There's not a lot of consensus on what's happening. So the research that we did at Duke, we were looking into ways that we could communicate those things from those types of commands or instructions from the car to the pedestrian. And we thought of replicating reproducing the same kind of signs that we see on street corners. Cross, don't cross, and that sort of thing. We put it on the front of a car. And what we found is that even when we told the pedestrians that they were there, they didn't even look at them. So we found that there's still some additional work that needs to be done to make the signs a little bit more obvious in the transition. The things that you're seeing at other universities like at UC San Diego and Virginia Tech, like I wrote up in that article, is that they're looking at the types of behaviors that you see in pedestrians when they're walking around autonomous cars. And they had the brilliant idea of creating a fake seat costume, basically, for the driver. So you had a driver that was hidden in a car because they were dressed as a seat. And so the car looked like it was completely driverless. So what they did is drive around town looking to see how pedestrians reacted to what was going on.
And what they find? What did people do?
Well, what they found, so at Virginia Tech, the results are still pending. That's still kind of a new research effort. And at University San Diego, we found it was kind of mixed. Some people gave the cars a lot of room to move around, and some people just didn't seem to notice and behaved as usual.
And as you point out, there are no standards for vehicle-to-pedestrian communications anyway, right, at the moment?
Right. And that's posing a bit of a problem, because what you see is that they're in the driverless car arena, as I'm sure you're seeing up in your home state, is that there's a big rush by a number of automobile manufacturers and tech companies to try to be the first to get their technology out there. And what you see is a lot of companies that are acting independently to get their technologies out as soon as they can. And what we're seeing is a lot of designs that there just hasn't been enough thought put into them. Like one of the ones that's been proposed by a couple of companies is to use text displays on their cars. And one of the warnings that's being floated around is something that says safe to cross. And when we looked into this in our lab, if you want this to be visible from even a very slim margin of safety for the distance, that sign would have to be about 4 feet across, which is way too big to have on any moving vehicle. So yeah, until there's some standards either agreed on by the automotive companies or by the Department of Transportation, then yeah, there needs to be some additional research to figure out what is the best way to present this information.
What is your best guess, knowing that you're researching this, digging into this? What do you think it ultimately will work out to be?
Yeah, so what you need to do, if we're talking about a warning that's for the purpose of safety, you want it to be as easy to understand, as quick, and as obvious as possible. So what is most likely what we're going to see is a simple symbolic or iconic display, maybe just a flashing light that's color-based or a very simple symbol that's combined with an auditory warning. So something like a beep that you would hear right now that's combined with some kind of a symbol on the front. And you see a few of these are emerging with car companies. Nissan in particular is looking into this area where they've created prototype vehicles that have these light arrays that circle around the entire car and have the ability to pulse or kind of move in a wave to communicate with the pedestrians. And there's some ongoing experiments there that I'm not privy to the results, but they're looking into how they might use those types of displays to communicate with pedestrians. And most likely something simple and obvious is going to be what we see in the future.
Do you think it could happen where the autonomous vehicle will have some kind of a signal that could communicate to the traditional walking signals we're used to seeing, the ones posted right across the intersection?
Oh, absolutely. I do think we're going to see that ultimately. So there are a number of different proposals that are available now for what's called vehicle-to-vehicle and vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. And this is going to be ways that cars can not only communicate with each other, but also with traffic lights, with pedestrian crossings, in school zones and things like that. So there's that two-way communication between those areas that will basically give the autonomous vehicles a more of a broad awareness of what's going on around them. I do think that is possible somewhere down the road.
What's the onus on the pedestrian?
Same as it is now. Like, one of the big problems that's going to be an issue down the road is that one of the main causes of fatalities in pedestrians is pedestrians stepping out into the road when there's no chance for the car to stop. Yeah. So there are still going to be situations where pedestrians are going to make bad choices about crossing away from lights, trying to pick the fastest route rather than the safest route. And if you step in front of a moving car, you know, whether there's a driver in it, whether there's not, I mean, it's still, it's a large vehicle, and they require a certain distance to stop. And if a pedestrian steps out in front of that window, they're still going to get hit. I think somewhere down the road, there is the possibility to enforce stricter speed restrictions on autonomous vehicles, since, you know, a human's not going to be in control anymore, and we might be able to slow them down a bit in urban areas, so at least cars won't speed when they're driving around pedestrians. But there still is going to be the onus on the pedestrian to make safe choices in the urban environment.
It is just one more aspect to all of this ongoing research on driverless vehicles, something we had not really thought about, but we're very glad we had a chance to kind of get your insights. Michael Klaman with Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab, looking into how do you make driverless cars safe for pedestrians. Michael, thank you so much for being with us. Really fascinating conversation.
Great, and thank you.
College campuses are filled back up with students, and that means stress on many levels for those students. Parents who say, hey, I had stress in my day and I got through it, might want to rethink that view. Michigan State University psychiatrist Dr. Farha Abbasi is here with us again, and it's always great to talk with you, Dr. Abbasi.
Thank you, Cindy.
When you think of the generations, from the last of the greatest generation to baby boomers, Gen X to millennials, on to Generation Z or the tweens, which of the generations is the most stressed out?
Well, I don't remember the rest of them and haven't seen the ones that are going to come, but definitely dealing with the millennials, I do realize that the stress levels have definitely been higher for this generation. They are facing more challenges than any generation before them.
Why is that, do you think? What kind of challenges are unique to that millennial generation, these young people that are showing back up for their college classes right now? Why are they so stressed?
I think one of the reasons being that if you go back one or two generations, doing high school was the ultimate thing. Now, even if they are done with their bachelor's, what they are hearing is that there are no jobs available, bachelor degree is not enough, you have to have a graduate degree. But on the other hand, if you look at the price of the college, just attending a graduate program, it has doubled. So, and then there is job market shrinking, the resources are shrinking for this generation, and then there is all this political chaos around us, the environment is changing, all that is creating a lot of pressure on these kids.
And do you think that, I am a baby boomer parent, I am the parent of a millennial, did baby boomer parents go too far, do you think, in cushioning and keeping kind of that bubble wrap around their precious child, where perhaps as that youngster comes of age and is on their own, maybe they're not as prepared to deal with disappointments and body blows?
Let's take a step back. So yes, we definitely do see that the coping skills have gone down. But the fact is it like we are like helicopter parents, too much protection. But I do feel like up till age 18, we protect them a lot. And then suddenly age 18, we want them to take over, be this adult overnight. As soon as you enter college, you are on your own. So I think definitely there is some self-reliance skills that needs to go in as soon as the kids are in high school. But at the same time, the support has to continue through the college years as well. Another point is that if we go back and look at the history of our country, these millennials pretty much have seen major three wars. The wars have taken not only a financial toll on our economy, on our systems, but also an emotional, traumatic toll on the mental health of these kids.
That's a real interesting perspective. The burner, that war burner, has been on constantly.
Absolutely.
With the start of a new school year, Dr. Abbasi, what kind of struggles do you see among the college students, among these millennials that are around you on the campus?
So we were talking about giving them a protective lifestyle, cushioning them. So yes, some of the kids coming to college are coming from vacations, are coming from these close-knit families and had like a very relaxed summer, were not like, you know, regular sleep hours. Everything was very fun. So for them, coming back to a rigorous college schedule can be tough and a big adjustment. On the other hand, there are kids that are coming back from very vulnerable or stressful situations. Kids coming back from, some might have, like, you know, lost loved ones or are facing coming to college and facing financial situations. Or we have a big situation with immigration ban that's going to have a spillover effect on the college students. So given all that, I still think we should approach every new year as a new beginning and a new possibility. And with the certain things in place, I think you can have a very fruitful and productive academic years.
Let's talk about the steps that that a student can take and a parent can encourage that student to take to help give you that fresh start with the new year and make it a productive year.
I think, let me highlight the most integral and important piece of this. It is about keeping the balance, finding that moderate point or living in moderation. So I see a spectrum, either the kids who are trying to get through these college years. They are trying to pile up the credits in one semester and do the most, and then they become overachieving, participate in too many clubs, too many activities because they are trying to build these resumes. They are already getting anxious, like, what's next? So neither do that, nor the on the other spectrum, I see kids who are very focused on thinking of college years as partying and take minimum required credits, do not participate in any meaningful activities, are more indulging in alcohol, drinking, and using substances. So instead of being on that spectrum, find that moderate point, the center point where you do have fun, but you do have a realistic load of classes. And in order to do that, having a discussion with your family, with academic counselors, setting your goals, dividing it into multiple years. So remember, college is not a race. It's not like you have to just finish it in certain time and compete with everyone. I always think college is like a marathon. You are not competing with others, but you need to find your own pace, your own strengths, and realize your own weaknesses.
And don't look over your shoulder to see what the people around you are doing, if it's better than you or not.
Absolutely.
When should a student seek help? At what point would you advise someone to reach out for help with depression or anxiety or stress?
Always thinking in terms of what's physiological and what's pathological. So if your anxiety, your stress levels are there to help you move forward, then yes, if it's making you function better, doing that is important. But if it starts to impair you, it starts to paralyze you, you are missing classes, you are not keeping up with the schedule, you are not able to turn in your assignments, all that is impacting your level of functioning. If it's impacting your relationships, if it's making you either become socialize too much or isolate, or if you are having thoughts of hurting yourself, or you feel like you're dying of anxiety, all those are concerning situations and should be dealt with on an urgent basis.
What kind of phrases might you offer parents if they get the text saying, I can't handle this, I'm having roommate problems, I'm overwhelmed with the amount of work, or they get the teary phone calls? What things can parents say that don't smother but help?
Please validate it. Don't just come out and say, but look at us, we managed it, and we had this pressure, and I was working two jobs and going through college. Validate your kids. listen to them. It is very important. Maybe you cannot physically do much or financially support them through situations, but emotional support, emotional validation of their experience. And then, you know, this is a very smart generation. They do come out with their own solutions. They figure out things on their own, but just not come out as giving them a sermon. You know, they are seeking you out because they want somebody to endorse their feelings of vulnerability. Let me end with one thing Einstein said, and let this be a message for the parents and the college kids, that Einstein said the mind that creates the problem cannot be the same mind that solves the problem. So it is important to keep focusing on the positive that's happening around you. Keeping your thoughts positive can be a very important part to your healing and for your coping skills.
Dr. Farha Abbasi, Michigan State University psychiatrist, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Jacob Meschke. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.